If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hey there. So the podcast is currently on an extended hiatus so that I can write my next book and work on some other exciting projects. But while we're away, I hope you'll enjoy this fan favorite episode from the archives. If you want brand new content to help you make peace with food and heal from diet culture, come sign up for my free weekly newsletter at christyharrison.com/newsletter, where I answer a weekly listener question. And as always, if you join my Intuitive Eating Fundamentals course at christyharrison.com/course, you get access to our exclusive monthly Q&A podcast where I answer all your new questions. Just go to christyharrison.com/newsletter and christyharrison.com/course to sign up or click the links in the episode description. Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast about intuitive eating, health at every size, body liberation, and taking down diet culture. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm an anti-diet registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, and author of the book Anti-Diet: Reclaim Your Time, Money, Well-Being, and Happiness Through Intuitive Eating, which is available wherever books are sold. Join me here every week as I interview interesting people from all different backgrounds about their paths toward peace with food and their bodies. And by the way, on this show, we bleep out diet culture stuff like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Welcome to episode 182 of Food Psych. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and today I'm talking with fellow anti-diet dietitian Kara Harbstreet. We talked about hypothalamic amenorrhea, aka not getting your period, and the lack of adequate care for this condition in conventional and alternative health. We also talked about the normalization of diet culture thoughts and behaviors in collegiate athletics and in dietetics education. Also, why thin privilege and other privileges don't necessarily protect a person from internalizing body shame, why you don't have any obligation to engage in or value movement or health, and so much more. It's a great episode. I can't wait to share it with you in just a moment. But first, I'll answer this week's listener question, which is from a listener named Jessica, who writes, "Hi, Christy. I love your podcast, and it has been a key tool in my recovery from binge eating disorder and the truly awful diet binge cycle that trapped me in self-loathing for years. I'm proud to say that since seeking outpatient treatment 2 years ago, my quality of life, happiness, relationships, and overall physical and emotional health have drastically improved. But lately, I'm really being tested in my recovery. I'm in a serious relationship and my partner and I are starting to think about having children. As part of this process, I went to see my gynecologist and she recommended I try to lose weight as a quote unquote natural way to regulate my hormones and increase my chances of conceiving. I voiced concerns to her and my partner about relapse and they both reassured me that I could make some quote unquote lifestyle changes that would result in weight loss without falling back into eating disorder behaviors. At first, I felt misunderstood, unsupported, and annoyed. Now I'm wondering if maybe they're right and I really could lose weight quote unquote in a healthy way. But that last sentence sounds a lot like something my eating disorder would say to me, and it is exactly the opposite of what my therapist always recommended. She told me that I don't need to lose weight and that I should not try to. What should I do? If losing weight will support me in having a child, maybe it would be worth it and I could really pull it off. So thanks, Jessica, for that question. And before I answer, just my standard disclaimer that these answers and this podcast in general are for informational and educational purposes only and aren't a substitute for individual medical or mental health advice. So yeah, Jessica, you're so right to be concerned that this is something your eating disorder would say. That's great intuition on your part. It really sounds like you're picking up on the diet culture messages in what your gynecologist told you and what your partner is saying as well. And it's really true that your gynecologist is coming from a place of diet culture. And so questioning this advice and feeling misunderstood and annoyed is so understandable and so right on, you know, like it's spot on of you actually to have those feelings, because that means that you're really solid in your recovery and you're doing the work and you're making an effort to notice these manifestations of diet culture wherever they come up. And so I'll push back on those thoughts that you were having of like, maybe I can quote unquote lose weight in a healthy way. No, that's not possible for anyone with your history or any sort of history of disordered eating. And it's really not possible to intentionally lose weight in a healthy way for anyone, period. And what I mean by that is intentional weight loss, trying to shrink your body, is inevitably going to interfere in your relationship with food and take you away from the peaceful and intuitive relationship with food that is your birthright, that is, you know, the thing that we're all born with is this intuitive eating skill. Intentional weight loss takes you away from that. So no matter how, quote unquote, healthily you're trying to pursue weight loss, there really is no such thing as a healthy way of doing it, because it all interferes with your relationship with food, takes you away from your intuitive eating skills, and actually makes your relationship with food more disordered, period, because diets create disorder. Intentional weight loss creates disorder in your relationship with food. And especially for anyone who's had a struggle with disordered eating or an eating disorder, intentional weight loss is incredibly risky. Dieting or lifestyle change or plans or protocols or programs to shrink your body, right? Whatever you want to call them. And lifestyle change is the word that your doctor and your partner used, right? No matter what you call it, that puts you at increased risk of relapse into your eating disorder, increased risk of using disordered behaviors again and falling down that rabbit hole of disordered eating that really got so bad. And it sounds like for you, you know that you want to be out of that diet binge cycle that trapped you in self-loathing for years, as you say. And there's really, unfortunately, no way to diet without it trapping you in that cycle again. So I would throw out any idea of making an effort towards weight loss, of intentional weight loss, and instead think about this, which is that hypothalamic amenorrhea, which we're going to be discussing in this episode, and other hormonal issues related to disordered eating likely have a lot more to do with the difficulty people in larger bodies sometimes can have in conceiving rather than weight itself. Because any study that shows that people in larger bodies might have more difficulty conceiving doesn't control for disordered eating, because unfortunately, basically no nutrition research does. I now know of one study that does, because I talked to the researcher for my book. I interviewed her for my book and we talked about this study that she worked on where she decided to control for it. And the only reason that that was even possible in that study is that she was working with a psychologist. She was a nutrition researcher, partnered with a psychologist, and they came up with that idea to control for disordered eating in this study. But that's basically unheard of in nutrition research or in medical research in general. Nobody controls for disordered eating unless they're specifically doing a study on disordered eating. So when you're talking about studies on like weight and conception, rates of conception or pregnancy in larger bodied people, for example, there's no way that those studies would have controlled for disordered behaviors among the people who are having difficulty conceiving. There's also no way those studies would have controlled for internalized weight stigma among those people. And that is another thing that can interfere in people's health. And it's, again, really unheard of for any studies to control for weight stigma. So hypothalamic amenorrhea, or HA, is unequivocally caused by restrictive eating, as well as overexercise and high-intensity exercise and chronic stress, and often also being at a lower weight than your body wants to be. So I'll put a link to a really good resource about hypothalamic amenorrhea in the show notes for this episode. I know that that's not necessarily, Jessica, what you have. You didn't mention that you have that, but just for anyone out there who's struggling to conceive, who might not be getting a period, That's what hypothalamic amenorrhea means, is not getting your period. And it's caused by those things, those disordered behaviors with food and movement. So if you happen to be experiencing HA, the best thing to do is not to try to lose weight, which we know is, again, a huge risk factor for HA, and also a huge risk factor for disordered eating and relapsing into eating disorders for people who've had them, right? Instead, if you have HA that's causing you to have difficulty conceiving, you'll want to work on healing your relationship with food and exercise, as well as work on stress management and allowing your body to get to the place where it really wants to be size-wise. And that might mean allowing yourself to gain weight. So for you, Jessica, I would recommend continuing to work on letting go of any lingering food restrictions that you have. And it sounds like you probably have some lingering diet culture stuff in your mind, since you are getting sort of tempted back by this recommendation from your gynecologist. So I'd recommend continuing to ease up, continuing to unearth those underground food restrictions that you might have, those sneaky ones, you know, sneaky diet mentality and diet culture thoughts that you might not even recognize, and allowing yourself to eat more food, easing up on any restrictions you might have about portion size or amount you eat, as well as perhaps reducing your exercise. And if you have hypothalamic amenorrhea, aka a missing period, completely stopping exercise until your period comes back or your cycle becomes more regular is really important. Also, a really important point I want to make here is that you should try conceiving first, right? Don't just assume that you're going to have trouble with conception just because of your body size. Recently, I read something, I can't remember where it was, but it made the excellent point that our culture has painted women and other people who can get pregnant as being completely responsible for the outcome of their conception and pregnancy, so much so that there's now this huge pressure to, quote unquote, prepare your body for pregnancy and do all this wellness crap before even beginning to try to get pregnant, before you even make an effort to conceive. People are now being pressured to jump through all these wellness hoops. And that's just total bullshit, right? That's just more of the wellness diet doing its thing as the latest and sneakiest manifestation of diet culture thus far. So truly, you do not have to jump through the wellness diet's hoops in order to conceive or in order to earn the right to even try to conceive, right? I think in this day and age, some people feel like they don't deserve to get pregnant if they haven't done all the things the wellness diet tells them to do. And that's absolutely not true. You deserve to get pregnant if you want to get pregnant. And you don't have to do those things in order to earn the right to try. I've had a number of clients who are jumping through those diet culture hoops before they came to work with me, and they were struggling to get pregnant. And then after we'd spent several months of working on easing up on their restrictions and making peace with food, they got pregnant. Well, go figure, you know? And those weren't even people who had missing periods or HA. Those were just dieters who were having unexplained trouble conceiving, likely because they were undernourished, because they were not eating enough. They were not allowing themselves enough variety. They were trying to do these wellnessy things that they thought were going to make their body healthier for pregnancy. And of course you would think that. Of course that's what's being sold to us in this day and age. And so of course you're going to believe that. But it was having the unintended consequence of actually keeping their body too suppressed in its ability to create hormones that they were then unable to get pregnant. So basically having the exact opposite effect of what it was supposed to do. So truly, to put yourself in a place where you're ready to conceive and be in the best possible place to conceive, just keep pushing forward in your recovery and don't try to lose weight. Instead, try to ease up even more on the diet culture restrictions that you've been putting on yourself. And if you have difficulty getting pregnant after trying for about 6 months, which is the average amount of time that it takes, then you can cross that bridge when you come to it. And at that point, if you are having trouble, you can look into working with a fertility specialist who's hip to health at every size and disordered eating issues and can help you without pushing weight loss. Because again, that's hugely risky to your recovery. And that also may have even more negative consequences on your fertility. So the bottom line is your intuition is spot on that it is actually eating disordered and diet culture-y to say that you should try to lose weight in order to get pregnant. That's not true. And that's not going to be helpful for you in your recovery or in your pregnancy. And you absolutely don't have to lose weight in order to get pregnant. And in many cases, it's actually giving up the effort to lose weight or follow the wellness diet that will ultimately help you conceive. So I hope that helps answer your question. And if you want to submit your own question for a chance to have it answered on an upcoming episode, you can go to christyharrison.com/questions. That's christyharrison.com/questions. And then if you want to ask me any question you want and have me answer it much more quickly, you can join my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals. The course has a wealth of audio and written content teaching you the principles of intuitive eating, plus an exclusive monthly Q&A podcast where you get to ask your own questions and listen to hundreds of answers I've given to other participants already so that you can work through all kinds of different sticking points in intuitive eating and really put it into practice in your own life. And I actually answered a question in there about hypothalamic amenorrhea a couple weeks ago, or I think on last month's episode. So you'll get access to that, plus literally hundreds of other questions that I've answered in the course. And when you join, you'll also get access to our private online community exclusively for course participants so that you can have some real-time guidance from me and my team, as well as hundreds of other great people who are on this intuitive eating journey with you. A participant named Megan recently finished the course, and she said, "This course has been an amazing journey for me. I appreciate all the time and effort you put into it." Another participant named Emily said, "You are just an effing legend. Since starting this course, I'm now making steps to starting a business, and that could never have happened without the freeing up of headspace that your content has created." If you're ready to become an intuitive eater and break free from diet culture once and for all, you can learn more and sign up for the course at christyharrison.com/course. That's christyharrison.com/course. This episode of Food Psych is brought to you by Blinkist. In this day and age, it can be hard to find the time to sit down and actually read a book, hence my not remembering where I had read that thing that I was quoting to you. But thankfully, there's Blinkist. Blinkist is the only app that condenses thousands of nonfiction books into the best key takeaways and need-to-know information, so you can read or listen to them in just 15 minutes. 8 million people are using Blinkist right now, and it has a massive and growing library, from self-help to business and health to history books. I really love Blinkist because in less than 15 minutes, I feel like I can get more informed on the topics I care about, but don't have time to keep up with. They have tons of books I've been meaning to read and am so excited to learn from, including Becoming by Michelle Obama, Emotional Intelligence by Daniel Goleman, and Good and Mad by Rebecca Traister. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/foodpsych to start your 7-day free trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/foodpsych, F-O-O-D-P-S-Y-C-H, like our name, to start your 7-day free trial. That's Blinkist.com/foodpsych. And now, without any further ado, let's go talk to Kara Harbstreet. So tell me about your relationship with food growing up.
So growing up, I have to say, I was extremely fortunate, and my family was never in a situation where we were food insecure or kind of searching around for where that next meal was coming from. And it's certainly something that now looking back, that was a big piece that I took for granted. But I grew up in the Midwest. I mean, kind of a traditional family setting. It was my parents, my sister, and I. And the one thing that I always think back on growing up is how much of an effort my parents put into family meals. I mean, we were constantly busy. We were both, you know, my sister and I, really active in sports and things outside of school. My parents served on the school board and had all these other things going on. But I just remember that growing up, you know, family meals were kind of a non-negotiable. It was like, okay, this is the time that the four of us get together, sit around the table, you know, have that time to spend together. And looking back, I mean, that's kind of slipped away just because of how hectic and busy our lifestyles are now. But I'm really thankful to have had that opportunity. And I would say that, you know, our relationship with food was always very neutral. It was not ever put on a pedestal. It wasn't, you know, like the mainstay of any conversation around the table. It was just kind of that time and that experience of being with family. And so I feel very fortunate that at least in the beginning, my relationship with food wasn't troubled in any way. It was really set up to be this association with family time and just enjoying a great meal. I would say that my father actually did the vast majority of the cooking. You know, my mom was certainly capable, but being as busy as we were, whenever it came down to things that were either made from scratch or maybe a little bit more involved, my dad actually took the reins in that area. And then I remember, you know, a lot of things that were sort of those convenience or highly processed foods that just get villainized all the time these days. But growing up, I mean, that was a staple of what we ate. So things like Hamburger Helper and Rice-A-Roni and all of the stuff that came out of the crock pot or things like that, that were just quick and easy and filled us up. Like I mentioned, I was an athlete. And so always being so active, I was just constantly hungry. And I would go through growth spurts where it was like, you know, I had a hollow leg was kind of the joke that my dad always told. And I'm sure other people have probably heard similar things, but I just had this like ravenous appetite. And so sometimes I would come home after school or after practice and rice-a-roni was like my go-to thing. And I could just go to town on that. And it was so savory and so comforting and so filling. And then I just remember kind of always associating that with being one of the first meals that I was capable of cooking on my own. And then from there, it sort of dovetailed into, you know, my dad teaching me a few more things in the kitchen and taking more of an interest of my own. And so afterwards, getting into kind of the college setting, that was really the first opportunity that I had to explore food outside of that family setting. But up until that point in time, it was always a really neutral, very calm type of setting around food, and really nothing that would have contributed to, you know, the future issues that I experienced with it.
Yeah, that's so nice that you had that base, that background. And it sounds like you were able to come together over food and also listen to your body and preserve that intuitive relationship with food that you were born with. No one was interfering in your relationship with your body.
Right. Well, and I also feel fortunate because in our family, I don't have any distinct memories of, you know, my mother dieting or this diet talk that was happening in family conversations. I think the closest we maybe ever got to that was, you know, my aunt and uncle would come to visit for Thanksgiving and they choose to eat vegetarian. And so that was kind of like the topic of conversation around their visit was like, oh my God, what are they going to eat? Like, we grew up in a very rural area, and in this small town setting, small town grocery store, the joke, you know, at the time was kind of like, what are they going to eat? And of course we know now, like there's no shortage of options, but you know, that was maybe the closest that we ever got to something that resembled diet talk. And it had nothing to do with things like body shape or size. It was simply the style of eating that they preferred to follow. So yeah, I feel fortunate in that regard as well, that I was never really exposed to this type of body shaming or food shaming conversation until a little bit later in life.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it sounds like maybe there was some body privilege in that too. You weren't struggling with your size. You weren't struggling with the messages you were getting about your size, and people in your family weren't sending those messages to you in any way. So you were able to just keep your relationship with your body intuitive and intact.
Exactly. Yes. It was a very hands-off type of relationship where food served that purpose. It just was like, hey, it is what it is. And certainly a lot of body privilege wrapped up in that, because there are those comments and things like that within privilege. And, you know, it's one of those things that you can kind of internalize in a negative way too. But fortunately, you know, in my experience growing up, that was never something that was directed at me in such a way that I took it to another extreme. The comments were certainly uncomfortable. And it's just like the awkward teenage years of when girls are growing up to begin with. I think we all sort of go through that in some way, shape, or form. But at least in my experience, the size and shape of my body was never a target of conversation or something that was critiqued or judged.
Right. That's a privilege, definitely, right? And that's what we mean when we say thin privilege. Like, I think sometimes the term thin privilege comes up in this podcast or in when I'm in conversations with people, and I sort of take it for granted that people understand what that means. But actually, I occasionally get emails and comments from people who say, you shouldn't be using the term thin privilege. If you're pro health at every size, you should really be about not saying thinness is a privilege. And of course, that's not what that means, right? It's actually thin privilege is just naming a system of oppression or a system of privilege that exists in society already that is not something that we're holding up or advocating. But thin privilege at its most basic is really sort of what you just described, of having the privilege of not having anyone interfere in your relationship with your body and your relationship with food, not having anyone critique your size or tell you that you need to shrink your body, and being able to just live your life and have your intuitive connection with food preserved as you go through life.
Right. And I've had this conversation off air and with other people in my network, and it's kind of the same story. You know, it doesn't negate the fact that you've had your own struggles or your own kind of body dysmorphia that you've had to work through. It simply means that, you know, from the outside looking in, you're able to move through the world in a way where you're not facing that stigma or bias on a day-to-day basis. It's not thrown in your face and it's not at the forefront of your perception the way that it is for other people. And so, yeah, I'm definitely very open about owning the fact that my thin privilege has opened opportunities for me that I maybe otherwise would not have had. And it's all kind of put me on the path to where I've come today. But being very transparent about that, I think can be empowering for other people to sort of turn inward and recognize their own privileges, because it is very nuanced and complex. And it's very possible to have privilege in one area and not in another. So it's always a very interesting conversation when it gets around to that.
Absolutely. And I think that's such a good point too. Saying that you have thin privilege doesn't mean that you're completely free of body shame. And in fact, people can have enormous amounts of thin privilege and also have body shame, eating disorders, disordered eating, really negative views of their bodies. And it's not mutually exclusive. And I, as someone who grew up with thin privilege as well, which again, just means that nobody was telling me to shrink my body. I wasn't getting those messages from parents or doctors or peers. And I was able to fit into airplane seats and theater seats and shop in mainstream stores, and all of that constitutes thin privilege. Even with that, I still developed an eating disorder. I still thought my body was too large. I still thought I needed to shrink my body. And that's because of the messages that we get in diet culture telling us our bodies aren't good enough every which way. And even people in smaller bodies internalize those messages. Even people in smaller bodies internalize weight stigma because we're told that we should fear getting larger, that we shouldn't become fat. So everybody's got this internalized fat phobia in our society. It just manifests in different ways for different people at different points along the size spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It doesn't negate those struggles because we're all unique and different. Our struggles are going to be unique and different. But at least for me, it was really kind of a testament to how insidious diet culture really is, especially having just described my background of growing up in this very stable household and the absence of diet talk or body shaming. And even yet, you know, when I kind of went out on my own and really was subjected to hearing those messages from other places, even I sort of fell victim to that, because in the absence of that support system and that reassurance, it really is easy to internalize that body shame regardless of your body size, simply because of the culture that we live in and the types of messages that we're exposed to day in and day out.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of us who come from a privileged background where we have a family that was supportive and helped us maintain our relationship with our bodies creates a buffer, but we're still getting inundated from diet culture from the outside, even with a family of origin that is really supportive. And so we're in this safe space, but we still are internalizing all these messages from diet culture. And then it's so easy when we end up getting outside of that safe space and sort of thrown to the wolves in a way of diet culture, that all of that stuff that we've sort of filed away in the archives over time that's come to us from diet culture ends up exploding to the fore. And so it's so easy for diet culture to catch us, even when we had that safe space for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
And so when that perfect storm hits of low self-esteem and being out on your own, it's so easy to tumble headlong into diet culture.
Right. And I think that was very much the case for me. You know, you mentioned kind of those late teens, early 20s. And I think that was truly the onset of when my issues with food and my relationship with my body really started to suffer. Because at that time, as I mentioned, being an athlete, I was fortunate to go on to compete at the next level at the collegiate level as a high jumper. And track and field is one of those sports where, of course, the uniforms are very form-fitting and sometimes revealing. And it was one of the first times that I was aware of my body as being more than just this way for me to move through the world. I kind of think back at times like that, and it may have been internalized. And of course, my memory at this point is a little bit foggy, but of course you take this high school athlete, you know, this standout who, you know, was doing great things, had achieved so much in her high school career. And I got dropped into this setting where instead of being a big fish in a small pond, I was like this teeny tiny fish in like the big wide ocean. And it was kind of a harsh reality check for me, because at least my perception of what that collegiate athlete experience was supposed to be ended up playing out very, very differently. And so as I was kind of grasping to find my footing again, I think that, as you described, just kind of opened the opportunity for that self-doubt to creep in and for comparisons to start and just being more aware of what my body looked like for the first time. As I think back, you know, that was one of the first times that I distinctly remember like those body checking behaviors coming into practice, because, every reflection that I saw of myself, whether it was a mirror or a window or the car door walking up to the track house, I'm constantly looking at my reflection and trying to think, okay, does this look the same as it did yesterday? Or like, how is my body changing? I can sense it, but can I also see it? And it was so uncomfortable. And it was such a distraction that looking back, I mean, my performance as an athlete suffered in numerous ways, but that was certainly a big piece of it, was just the level of discomfort that I felt being in my body and sort of being in the spotlight and having so much attention cast on it and in such a weird way that I wasn't accustomed to as a high school athlete.
When you were competing at the collegiate level, how did that body shame and relationship with your body first start to play out for you?
So it was interesting because I don't know that there was ever this like watershed moment that I recognize as being like, oh, there it is, like, you know, the catalyst for everything that came afterwards. I think it was such a gradual onset that I truly didn't actually see it for what it was until I had the perspective of being removed from it for a couple of years. And I kind of remember, you know, little things that came across, you know, like a comment from a coach or comments that were being made about other athletes and their bodies. And I now recognize that as being like one of those ways that I was just internalizing it for myself. But it would be things like, well, as a high jumper, it's advantageous to be lighter or leaner and to be more, a more powerful athlete. You know, this is what the training demands. And so I think that was something that I had never really experienced as a high school athlete coming from such a rural area. You know, we really didn't have a very robust strength and conditioning program. My coaches, at least, were never very knowledgeable. And for the most part, I was training almost exclusively under male coaches. And so the dynamic between a female athlete and a male coach was always contentious in a few ways, because it was like this sort of line in the sand that was a little bit blurry as far as what they felt was appropriate to say and what we felt it was appropriate to ask for or set boundaries against. And looking back, I mean, that was certainly not something that I exercised as well as I could have, as far as just voicing discomfort about things that were being said about not only my body, but young female athletes in general. And looking back, this certainly was not exclusive to the track and field program. And I don't think it's exclusive to just my university either. But, you know, also hearing comments from other athletes when, you know, you're involved in the sport and it takes up so much of your free time, it's only natural that you start to sort of run in the same circles as other athletes from other teams or other sports. And I was also hearing similar things about athletes on those teams. So things would be said like, so-and-so just isn't the same athlete that we recruited because of this weight gain that she had experienced. Oh. Or yeah, it was, you know, things like that, you know, at risk of losing your scholarship over this, you know, is very performance-based. And so to gain that competitive edge, we were really willing to try anything. And at least in my case, what that started to manifest as was really compulsive overexercising, just above and beyond what was required for my sport, above and beyond what was really beneficial for my performance. And as I mentioned before, there were a lot of things that kind of played to the detriment of my performance over the years, but that was another one that really just was not helpful in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, that is really problematic because, I mean, when you're overexercising and you're also expected to compete in a certain sport, that's got to be taking so much energy away from the rest of your life, right? Like taking away any other free time that you might have or time that you want to devote to other pursuits, but also even taking away from the sport itself, because now you're directing all this energy toward exercising in other ways too, and not just the movement that you're meant to be doing.
Exactly. And again, I was fortunate in a lot of ways. I never experienced an injury that would have ended my career. But at the time when minor things would pop up, you know, I did end up taking a redshirt year because of a back injury. And one of my immediate thoughts at the time, you know, being so deep into this body dysmorphia and this fear of weight gain, feeling all of this pressure that was really more self-induced than anything, one of my immediate first thoughts was, oh my God, if I can't go to practice, what am I going to do? Because the very first thing that I was thinking of was the recognition that my body would likely change as a result of being less active. And it was a really uncomfortable time in so many ways. But to your point as well, it was also distracting in these other pursuits. And so I was always a high achiever as far as academics, being involved in things like having a job outside of my class and track schedule and things like that. And so kind of across the board, you know, it just started to almost like fray at the ends a little bit. And then there were times when anxiety would bubble up and get to the point where it was almost unmanageable. And at least for me at the time, it never really developed into anything further than that. But it certainly was a huge distraction and just kind of a time suck. I mean, all of this energy and brain space going into these things that really in the long run were not the most important things at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like diet culture, the life thief, as I'm always saying, right? It steals, steals away your time and your energy for other pursuits and things that you want to be doing in life and just keeps you fixated on food and body stuff, or in your case, exercise stuff too, compulsive exercise.
Right, right. And I think that in those collegiate settings, there's often this lack of awareness of how problematic these behaviors are because they very easily can be cast as being so normal. It's extremely normalized to see an athlete at this level who is in the gym for or who is being really meticulous and careful about what they're eating. Sometimes it's chalked up as being a desirable attribute. You know, it's like, oh, they care so much about their performance. Look at them being so diligent. This is great. When in reality, that's often just the disguise that this disordered eating behavior takes on. And because of the setting that it's in and that athletic background, people cast it as being very normal. So things like that weren't really picked up by coaches or teammates or the athletic trainers that we had access to. And I think that's probably one of the biggest things that, looking back, it should have been a huge red flag. And no one really picked up on it at the time. And even myself, until years later, didn't really look back and say like, oh, well, you know, that probably wasn't the best thing that I could have been doing.
It sounds like they were so caught up in diet culture themselves, too, if they were saying these comments about people's body size changing as being the reason for their performance or whatever. That seems like they were just also very caught up in diet culture, very caught up in the disordered mindset about food and movement and body size, and probably had no idea. You know, I feel like the people who are the most caught up in those things often just have no awareness of the disorder that they're creating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I think with the training and education that I've done in the areas of sports nutrition and working with athletes, the interesting thing about it is that we've got plenty of examples at our fingertips of athletes who have relinquished control or they've loosened up on their food rules and their performance has actually improved. And so that's kind of one of the things that will keep me up at night if I let it go. But I really try not to think about it much. But it's kind of begging the question of, you know, if these disordered eating behaviors weren't present and I was able to truly focus on performance as an athlete instead of the way that my body looked or how it was perceived by others, what would the difference maybe have been? Maybe performance-wise, there wouldn't have been a huge difference, but I know for a fact that I would have been a much happier athlete, which is also really important for things like stress management and recovery and just that emotional well-being that was certainly missing at times for me.
Absolutely. And I know you mentioned on your podcast too that you had some health complications as well as a result of this overexercise and undereating. Can you talk a little bit about the effects that it had on your body? You said that you had a back injury as well. And I know you had some hormonal stuff that went on as well that people didn't notice, again, that the coaches or doctors weren't really aware of.
Yeah. So on my podcast, we had a recent episode that brought up hypothalamic amenorrhea. So we can, I'm sure, link to that in the show notes. But in a nutshell, it's the absence of a normal menstrual cycle. And it's usually attributed to something like what we called in the past as female athlete triad. And so for someone who is this very active or, you know, highly trained individual, you know, they're in this kind of chronic state of being overly active and underfueled. And at least in my case, it was challenging to pinpoint it because I never met that classic criteria of being extremely lean or underweight, in air quotes, because again, what even is that? But it wasn't those classic symptoms that would have flagged me in the eyes of our athletic trainers or coaches. And really, the only reason that it was even under suspicion was because of that irregular cycle. You know, in going for my annual exam, it kind of got brought up just in conversation with the gynecologist that I was seeing at the time. And she offered to do a little bit of further investigation. And at the time, you know, my health insurance was covered. I was like, okay, great. Let's dig into it and see what's going on. Just, you know, maybe for curiosity purposes only. I really wasn't intent on doing anything about it because as young as I was, planning a family and future fertility was like the furthest thing from my mind. But I was like, okay, if I can at least avoid this like unpredictability in my cycle, that would be great. So let's do it. And looking back, you know, there were certainly some things that she could have done that didn't get picked up. And at the time, what it led to was what I feel is a misdiagnosis of PCOS. They did a few ultrasounds and things like that and just sort of chalked it up to saying, okay, well, you're kind of an atypical presentation of PCOS because I didn't display any of the other kind of hallmark or classic symptoms or signs that they would have been looking for. And I walked away from that experience sort of thinking like, okay, like, I don't really know my body right now, but clearly you don't really know my body either because I feel this isn't accurate. But again, I wasn't really in that mindset to dig any further at that point. So we continued to do a little bit of monitoring and things like that. And it was really just brushed aside as saying, this is your cycle. This is the way it's going to be. If and when you do decide that you want to start a family, come back and see us and we'll talk. So it was very much brushed under the rug. And at that point, I kind of moved forward and took it upon myself to do a little bit more education, at which point I, you know, kind of came full circle and realized that most likely what that presentation was actually not PCOS, but a form of hypothalamic amenorrhea.
Mm. And so for anyone who's listening who doesn't know what hypothalamic amenorrhea is, can you just talk a little bit about the causes and the typical understanding of it as you know now and as this gynecologist probably should have known as well, especially working with a female athlete?
Right, right. So as you mentioned earlier, there's all this disruption in hormones that's happening. And, you know, it can be attributed to a number of things, but in a lot of cases, it is that state of being extremely highly active and very restricted in how you're eating. And so that was another confusing point for me as I was doing that work and reflecting back on it. You know, I never would have met the criteria of anorexic style behaviors or extreme restriction to the point of what's displayed in some other cases. And so in my mind, it was like, oh, all this restriction, like, where was it? There was never a point in time where I felt I met that criteria either. But with hypothalamic amenorrhea or HA, there's also typically a stress component. And, you know, your hypothalamus is this gland that kind of directs other body processes and functions. It's really important, but it doesn't often get a lot of attention until it's not behaving as expected. So it was kind of one of those things where I think the stress component in my case was just layer upon layer of all these areas in my life that I felt I had to measure up. And like I said before, I think so much of the pressure that I placed on myself was really self-induced. I certainly wasn't receiving it from my parents or professors or friends. It really was being piled on by me. But I think the stress component in my case was also a huge factor in that disruption that I experienced. So it can certainly manifest in very different ways. It could be the total absence of a menstrual cycle. It could be very sporadic or irregular. But as we have already said, you know, for a lot of providers who are seeing this in clinical settings, they may not recognize those signs and symptoms as being attributed to HA. They may think that it's very normalized, or they don't fully dig into someone's history to realize where those red flags are popping up and how they could potentially address them in a way that really supports long-term health and can bring the body back into balance if those restricted behaviors or high stress behaviors are taking place.
And it's so interesting how there's this sort of dismissive attitude sometimes, I think, from gynecologists or more mainstream medical practitioners that they're like, well, we don't know and it's not a big deal and just go on the pill or come back and see us if you want to get pregnant. And that's really frustrating because for anyone who's gone through it, and I went through it myself too, like it's sort of maddening. You're like, well, I should be getting a period. It was very regular for however many years and suddenly it's not, like, what gives? And then there's on the other side, I've seen a lot recently, and I was just talking about this in my online course with someone who brought up the fact that now there's all these so-called hormone experts who are saying, you know, if you have an irregular period or if you have amenorrhea or hormonal issues, it's because you're eating sugar, it's because you're eating dairy, it's because you're eating gluten. Like, they'll blame it on food stuff. And then they'll say you need to cut out these foods to correct your hormones, when in fact, when it is hypothalamic amenorrhea, which I think is the most common form of hormonal issue to affect people with periods.
Right.
And PCOS, I think, is considered to be very common as well, but is often misdiagnosed too. Like, I was also misdiagnosed with PCOS when I had hypothalamic amenorrhea back in the day when I was overexercising and undereating. And again, no one picked up on it. No one asked about it. And so, you know, it really is such a common thing, but you have people on the traditional medical Western medicine side kind of dismissing it in large part. And then you have the people on the alternative medicine side in large part saying, oh, it's because you have to cut out all these foods and let's find out what food is causing it, or it's sugar, or it's dairy, or whatever. And meanwhile, this obvious elephant in the room that nobody's talking about is that in diet culture, so many, like 75% of women by some estimates, have some form of disordered eating or eating disorder. And a lot of people that I've mentioned that statistic to are like, really? That's it? I think it would be more, you know, because pretty much everyone in our culture has some kind of fucked upness around food because of diet culture. So we're not looking at this problem that is sort of the most obvious, like Occam's razor. If someone comes in and says, I'm not getting a period, or I'm having irregular periods, the most parsimonious, most obvious thing to look at first really should be, let's talk about your relationship with food. Let's talk about your relationship with movement. Let's talk about your stress levels, because all of those things are so incredibly common in diet culture. And when we send people on these goose chases of like, maybe it's sugar, maybe it's dairy, or I don't know, just come back in 10 years when you want to get pregnant, we're really doing a disservice to people's health.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm not sure how your experience was in that misdiagnosis. This is another prime example of thin privilege, because at that time, being as active as I was, it was a well-known fact that I was a college athlete. Their advice to me was not to go out and lose weight. However, for so many people who do receive a diagnosis of PCOS or anything else to do with hormonal imbalances or whatnot, that is often the next piece of advice, is not only go into these restrictive behaviors and start eliminating entire food groups from your diet, but in addition to that, the first thing that you should try to do is lose weight. And so thankfully, you know, that wasn't the message that I was receiving. However, there was a little bit of an element of fear tactics involved, because with hormonal imbalances, of course, we start to look at the endocrine system as a whole. And with type 2 diabetes being somewhat associated with PCOS or metabolic syndrome, you know, down the rabbit hole in that direction, you know, their advice to me was basically, going forward, you know, you'll have to be really careful around carbs. And yeah, I kind of took that and was just like, okay, like, you really don't know my body, because I feel like I'm one of those people where, I mean, carbs really are my life. If I think of my favorite foods, it is like all of them are in that category. So
me too.
To me, I almost tucked it aside with the fact that, like, okay, I'll deal with that when it happens. Not going to go there. I'll give up a lot of things, but I'm not giving up that. So I think, you know, that's another kind of nuanced layer of that is, you know, the fear tactics that are involved with diagnoses of that sort. And that can really play into that internalization of diet culture and that fear and mistrust around food, and in turn, mistrusting your body. It's like, you know, my body, what do you mean? It's not able to handle, you know, kind of quote unquote, handle or manage the way that I've been eating previously. So now what? And of course, the answer that diet culture tells us is what we should be doing is going back to restriction, which, as we know, is definitely not the solution that we're looking for.
Oh, absolutely. That's such a great point too, that this is another form of thin privilege, where not being told to lose weight to manage hormonal conditions is thin privilege, because that's the next step that so many people unfortunately have to endure, is like, not only are they being told that they should cut out all these foods, but also they should be losing weight. And of course, we know that there's really no way to do that in the long term that is sustainable or health promoting. And the very small percentage of people that are able to lose weight and keep it off for more than 5 years are generally really consumed by diet and food and exercise and body thoughts, basically diet culture thoughts, every single second of their lives. And it really robs them of life and oftentimes is a very disordered, arguably all the time, a very disordered relationship with food. So we know that it just doesn't work. And yet doctors and other health professionals are still doling out this advice to lose weight when, again, the most obvious thing, the most parsimonious answer, Occam's razor, really says, like, look at what they're doing with food. Look at their restrictive behaviors or overexercise behaviors. And I think it's also important to point out that even if someone is not thinking of themselves as quote unquote objectively overexercising or objectively eating too little, because diet culture so normalizes restriction and so normalizes instrumental exercise, diet culture has a high bar for what people are supposed to consider too much, because basically diet culture is always telling you to do too much. And it's just, that's considered what's normal. And so I think, I mean, for me, when I was in this space, and I know for a lot of clients that I've had who've struggled with this, it was very hard to get my head around, like, well, I can't be exercising too much. I'm only exercising the amount that I should be, quote unquote, per diet culture, I should be. But I had really internalized that belief that, no, I really should be doing it this much, and this is not excessive. Or I really should be eating this little, and this is not excessively little. Like, I'm not, quote unquote, anorexic, you know, in my mind at the time, that's what I thought. Well, to have anorexia is to, like, not eat at all, or to eat so much less than what I'm eating. And I'm eating plenty, you know, it, quote unquote, should be enough for my body. The calorie trackers say that it's enough for my body. So it can't be, this amenorrhea I'm experiencing can't be due to how little I'm eating.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, of course it was, because that was still incredibly restrictive. And looking back now from a healed place, I can see it absolutely was way too little food for my body and way too much exercise for my body. But at the time, I was so in denial about it, I just couldn't see that.
Right. I also think it's so interesting that you bring up calorie trackers, and this was all taking place simultaneously. I hadn't originally started out as a dietetics major. My interest in nutrition really, again, kind of manifested from this obsession with micromanaging my eating style and just a deepened interest because of my athletic background. But along the way, you know, I feel like it's also worth pointing out that a lot of the dieting behaviors that later morphed into a true eating disorder behavior was actually something that was taught to me through my dietetics education. And for something like calorie tracking, you know, I remember in our nutrition courses, there would be these, you know, semester-long projects, or, you know, kind of like these capstone projects that we had to complete. And oftentimes what that involved was some aspect of food journaling or tracking meals, running a nutrition analysis on your diet, and kind of reporting back. And so participating was mandatory. It's not as if you could opt out of your senior capstone project or whatever. So that really reinforced, as you said, you know, in the context of what I was seeing on paper, it was hard for me to reconcile that in my mind, because what I was tracking and what I was observing through this journaling process was that, okay, this should, quote unquote, be enough. And in the context of how active I was and how compulsive my exercise behaviors had become, it truly wasn't enough. It wasn't even coming close, you know, in my estimation. I really have no concept of how many calories are in food anymore. I mean, I've thankfully just removed that from my consciousness, I guess.
But yeah, same.
You know, it's one of those things where it was made even more confusing by the fact that I was having a hard time reconciling that. And then along the way, of course, we learn these other dieting behaviors, because in a very traditional dietetics education, it's a weight normative setting. You know, weight loss is commonly talked about, and the education that we receive to go on and become dietitians is often rooted in the idea that health is only improved when weight loss is achieved and maintained. And as we've said before, that simply is not an option or reality for so many people.
Oh, that's so true. And that's such a sad state of affairs that, like, the things that you were being taught in your dietetics education were the very things that drove you into an eating disorder. But I think it's so understandable and so common that that would happen, because these behaviors that we are teaching to people in order to supposedly make them quote unquote healthy are actually behaviors that are incredibly disordered and take them away from a truly health promoting, truly peaceful relationship with food. And so, of course, the logical conclusion of that would be an eating disorder. But all along the way, it is disordered. Like, it's disordered behavior no matter what, even though some people are able to relate to it in a way that doesn't go, quote unquote, too far by diet culture standards.
Mm-hmm. I think with the dietetics profession as well, if you really look at the types of demographics that are attracted to this profession, we've mentioned the lack of diversity in our field numerous times. And in at least in my mind, this is an ongoing and active problem that I hope to contribute some solutions to in the future. But at the time, you know, gearing up for this DICUS round of matching, and for those who don't know, it's a really fucked up process of trying to just finish your education, get to the end of the road, move on with your life. And for me, you know, the pressure that I was feeling as far as becoming a good applicant involved other things that, looking back, were actually catalysts for other things. You know, in some ways it was a very gradual onset, but then looking back, in my case, something like a binge eating behavior was really brought on by some of the things that I was doing in an effort to make myself a better candidate for these internship applications. And the experience that I'm specifically thinking of is a couple of summers that I spent in upstate New York as a camp counselor. And at this point, I would just slap like a trigger warning or content warning on what I'm about to say, because it was a weight loss camp for children. And it was one of those things where, at the time, coming from such a weight normative education, in my very disordered mind at the time, that was one of the things that I thought would turn me into a stronger candidate. You know, to have this experience of working with children and teens at the summer camp, teaching them nutrition, teaching them cooking skills, asking them to step on the scale. You know, this is another one of those things that will really keep me up at night, is thinking about the undue damage that I potentially caused. And again, with something like binge eating, it was one of those things that I never displayed that behavior until I worked at a weight loss camp. And I think that's just another example at how diet culture can really just persuade you to keep going down that rabbit hole, regardless of your background, because it was one of those things that came on very suddenly and was actually very uncomfortable and scary at the time, because it was like, whoa, like, what just happened? This is brand new. I'm not sure what this is, but I don't like it.
And you were probably in an environment that completely demonized that. So you're surrounded by these messages of like, eat less, eat less. And then you're finding yourself feeling out of control with food. So I can see how scary that would be.
Yeah. And it's that classic pattern of, you know, the pendulum swinging from one extreme to the other. And again, until years later, I didn't have the perspective to see it for what it was. But whenever that topic of conversation comes up nowadays, I'm really transparent about the fact that, you know, in the long run was not a positive experience for me. And I would not recommend it in any way, shape, or form for someone who is at all concerned or worried about the shape or size of their child's body. It's like, this needs to be the last option. It shouldn't even be an option. That should just be cleared off the table. And you can explore just about anything else before you go down that route.
Yeah, it's so, so detrimental to poor kids' health and well-being and self-conception as well. It's really sad that people feel the need to send their kids to camps like that. And yet I get it, because diet culture tells parents that that's what needs to happen. And, you know, our medical system is so steeped in diet culture that dietitians and pediatricians and all these health professionals are telling parents, you know, your kid needs to lose weight in order to be healthy. And of course, parents want their kids to be healthy. Of course, parents want their kids to have a good life and to live a long time and not have to struggle. So I think they think they're doing the right thing, but it's just so sad how unfortunately wrong that is, and how twisted we've all gotten about this concept of health, that people think that that's actually going to do good, when it's in fact setting kids up, unfortunately, for a lifetime of things like binge eating and other disordered relationships with food in their bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a tough experience, because there were certainly fun aspects. I mean, there were opportunities wrapped into that opened doors for me. And so it's hard to look back and just cast this blanket over the whole thing and say that it was negative across the board. But at least in that aspect, it certainly was not helpful in any way. And I think it's another one of those areas where scare tactics can really come into play, because of course you're doing this in the name of prevention, right? Like, if you can just get a handle on it now, if you can prevent future health problems, growing bodies should not be subjected to any type of messaging about weight loss. These are our young kids, teens who haven't gone through puberty yet, that whole thing. And it's just like, wow, we are really doing untold damage with this as far as their entire future when it comes to food and their body and the messages that they've been hearing from such a young age. It's, I think in some cases, just impossible to let that go. You may build that resilience where you're not compelled to act on that, but those memories aren't going anywhere. Like they are just seared into your memory bank forever.
And it's traumatic. I think really being so disconnected from your body and having loved ones and caregivers actively work to disconnect you from your body at such a young age is a form of trauma. And that's something that people really need a lot of support and practice and time to work through. And yeah, you know, those memories might never fade, but at least you can learn to navigate them and not have to respond to the voice in your head telling you to lose weight or telling you to eat less or telling you all the terrible stuff it's telling you.
Right, right. And I think that's where, you know, off air, we were talking about that personification of diet culture and how it came through for me. And that's exactly what it was. You know, those thoughts in my mind that were so hypercritical and judgmental. I mean, I was certainly hearing them from external places as well, but at least for me, the persona that it took on was very much one of that like catty high school mean girl. And now looking back, to have been able to put a name on that has been so helpful to just being able to recognize it for what it is. It's like, there it is. You know, that's diet culture speaking up. This isn't actually something that's going to serve me. I can remember a past experience, or I can think back on something I was once compelled to do, but I now have, thankfully, enough trust and wherewithal as far as where I want to be and how it may not serve me to be able to resist that much better than I had been in the past.
Yeah, that's huge. I think being able to recognize it and give it a persona is so helpful at starting to distance yourself from it and starting to disconnect it from just like, this is me, you know, because I think when we're in it, when we're really stuck in those disordered thoughts, it can feel like, well, this is just me. I'm the one doing this to myself, or I'm the one making these decisions. But in fact, it's this part of you that's internalized from the outside, that's internalized from diet culture, that's not really you per se. It's a part of something else that you've taken in and that is now barking out orders at you in your head, like that mean girl that's, you know, not actually who you are, not the truth of who you are.
Mm-hmm. And I think the environments that we find ourselves in, or the types of people that we allow into our lives, can either manifest that further or can help build that buffer to help you distance yourself from it even more. And I know, at least in my case, one of the best things that led to healing as far as my relationship with food and my body was actually moving away from a very weight normative type of dietetics practice. And so when I was first discovering intuitive eating and beginning my journey of learning about health at every size and all the intersections that it can take in these other areas, that was about the time that I last worked in a corporate setting that was very focused on weight loss and wellness programming. So at that point, I felt like I had enough free space. You know, the air kind of cleared and the dust sort of settled from all of the things that were entailed in that position that I no longer had, that I was doing a different type of work. It really wasn't focused in wellness programming, but it did involve a lot of individual counseling. And that was one of the first opportunities that I had to really turn inward and say, okay, what is it that I really want for myself? Is this something that I want to pursue again? Or am I, you know, ready for something different? And thankfully, that's when I was making introductions with so many great dietitians and therapists and other people that are already working in the intuitive eating and Hayes informed spaces, that it kind of just filled that void that was made when I started to push diet culture away and start to reject it for the first time. And so at the time, it wasn't really something that I was consciously doing. But again, with perspective, looking back, it was sort of this perfect storm of elements that made room for that. And I was thankfully in a mindset where I could allow that into my life and say that, yes, this is really the direction that I do want to go.
Yeah. How did you start to push diet culture away and recognize that that wasn't for you anymore? Like, how did you get from that place of being the collegiate athlete who was struggling so much and nobody could figure out what was going on with you to actually starting down the path to healing?
Yeah, interesting because one of the other manifestations of my disordered eating behaviors was going towards a plant-based diet. And for me, I kind of was toying with that idea for a while. I would toss it out there, see how I felt, kind of say, no, I actually really like eating meat, and put it aside. But then post-college, in kind of that first year after graduating, I was in this huge transition because, as I mentioned with our internship application process, I actually didn't match my first round of internships. And this was just devastating to me as a very type A perfectionistic type person. You know, I had poised myself as this perfect candidate and been told by so many people that I was a prime candidate, and then to not match, you know, that was the first time that I experienced a full-blown panic attack. And in that transition year between finally being matched into a program where I went on to complete my internship and my master's, I was sort of in flux and just really trying to gain my footing in a different city, you know, a new set of friends, kind of carving out this different identity for myself. And that was a really good opportunity to say, hey, I now identify as a vegetarian. And when that finally came full circle, you know, to make a long story short, I eventually arrived at the place where I was craving things like barbecue that my dad would make on the grill, or we would be at a family function and I would have to eat the spaghetti sauce without meatballs. And I got really frustrated with having to miss out on those experiences while also recognizing that the meals that I was eating at the time were less than satisfying. I talk a lot about the difference between physical fullness and true satisfaction. And I think that's where the light bulb started to click on, was recognizing that I actually don't enjoy this as much as I'm telling myself I do. It's just me trying to live up to this identity that I've carved for myself. But this isn't the real me. This isn't authentic. And this isn't what I want. I want to be able to go to town on this rack of ribs that my dad pulled off the grill. So at that point, I was prepared to really say, okay, why am I doing this? And what's the reason for it? Am I ready to let that go? And that's, I think, the first real memory of consciously saying, I'm going to loosen up on these food rules and see how it feels to try something different.
That's amazing. And how did it go from there? Did you have resistance to it at first when you were doing it? Was it scary? Like, how did you feel?
It was exciting, actually. I mean, looking back, I think it was very much that exploration phase that they describe with intuitive eating, because I was allowing all of these foods back into my eating pattern that I had previously denied myself for so long. And it was scary in the sense that I was questioning at times, okay, like, how far is this going to go? Like, where is it going to stop? How long is this going to last? Does it need to stop? You know, even kind of questioning, like, would it be the worst thing if, you know, I was the dietitian who never, quote unquote, ate healthy food again. And so I've written a little bit about it on my blog to kind of describe that journey to being a vegetarian and then swinging back from that. But there's one particular example that always comes to mind, and I called it my drive-through cheeseburger phase, because that's exactly what it was. You know, coming from a plant-based style of eating and with my dietetics education, fast food is something that is so commonly villainized. In my mind, you know, a fast food cheeseburger was like the absolute worst thing that I could have ever eaten. So of course, that was something I didn't let myself have for the longest time. And as I was moving through that reintroduction phase and exploring these foods that I hadn't been eating very often, that was sort of like the epitome of what that exploration phase looked like for me. I was hitting every drive-through joint in town trying to find my favorite cheeseburger, because at least at that point, I had read through the book, I had started to embody some of the principles, and I knew that, okay, if I'm craving a cheeseburger, what's really going to get the job done is the cheeseburger that I want the most. My favorite one that is cooked just right, that I can reliably go get whenever I'm having the craving for. And so that exploration phase sort of had this purpose behind it in a way. It was like, okay, I'm not going to waste my time on these really crappy cheeseburgers. I just want to go get the best one that I can find and move on with my life. Because simultaneously, I was recognizing that as I was venturing into private practice for the first time and starting to kind of build my personal brand as a dietitian, I wanted to be devoting my energy to that. Like, I didn't want to be so wrapped up in all these thoughts about food that we're consuming every waking moment. So I think my logic at that point in time was basically like, get me the best thing that's going to satisfy me, get the job done so that I can move on to these other really exciting things that I want to grow and that I want to focus on.
Yeah. So it sounds like you were really starting to take your life back. The life thief you kicked out of your life and had all this other stuff that you wanted to do. And I think that's such a beautiful aspect of intuitive eating when people can start looking at food as just, yeah, it's pleasurable and I want to have things that satisfy me. And in the early stages, I want to move through the phase of like eating all the things that were previously off limits to show myself that I can. But also like there's a million other things I've got going on that I want to tackle and do in my life. And I'm not going to let the stuff about food and exercise and body size hold me back.
Right, right. And I tell people all the time, now being moderately successful in a lot of areas of my business, that's a common question. What helped you along the way, or what do you chalk this up to? And it's, of course, an infinite number of things. But one of them is really being able to say, this is more important than hanging on to these food rules. This restriction and this obsession around food is not actually getting me anywhere. It's not moving the needle on my business, my personal life, you know, my professional growth, my learning. It just is there. And it's comfortable and it's familiar because I've done it for so long, right? Like I can go back to that anytime I want to, but now I can thankfully truly say like, there's no part of me that wants to go back to that because I've seen what's on the other side and it's so fulfilling and so satisfying. And there are so many fun things that come out of it. And it's introduced me to some amazing people that I'm just so glad to have in my life, that to think that this would not have been possible if I was still so wrapped up in those disordered eating behaviors. It's like, yeah, I mean, looking back with that perspective, it was a no-brainer to let that go. But I don't want to negate that at the time, it was a huge struggle. It's only now being on the other side and trusting that process and staying patient with it to be able to discover that on the other end of things.
I love that. And I'm also curious how your relationship with movement changed. How have you been able to embrace joyful movement or just a relationship with movement that isn't disordered and excessive after your experience with overexercise and also just being a collegiate athlete too, which I assume you're not competing at a sort of professional level anymore because you've got so much else going on in your life. So
of course, yeah, that's an area I've really had to let go of. But I mean, that is a really good question because again, it wasn't ever a conscious decision. It was kind of this gradual letting go and making space for new things. And so as I described in that year between my undergrad and my master's program, I was living in a new city. And for that year, I was just open to trying other things. That was my first true experience with real yoga. And I put real in air quotes because during my collegiate days, we did the version of P90X yoga, which was, of course, steeped in diet culture and all this talk about bodies that I don't think is representative of what any authentic form of yoga takes on. And so that was really exciting to discover. And at this point in time, I had to take a little bit of a break from running because as much as I love that aspect of training for a race, I really had to hit pause on that to try and ask myself, you know, is this a behavior that I'm doing in an effort to control my body size? Or is this a self-care practice that provides these other things that are important? And there definitely was a time where I was relying on endurance exercise as a form of managing my body size. And to temporarily let that go not only opened up space to find other forms of movement that I do really enjoy, but I've now been able to return to that with a recognition that I am more in tune with my body and listening to what it tells me. That competitive aspect of my personality is very much still there, but it's not the most important reason of why I would go out and go for a run. I'll often leave my GPS watch at home and just run according to how I'm feeling instead of the pace that my watch is telling me. I'm training more based on time instead of mileage. And so there's just small tweaks in there that without the perspective of being where I am now and then having support from people like Heather Kaplan, who is the running coach that I worked with as I was training for my first marathon, putting things like that into practice, I think has brought it more full circle than I would have otherwise been able to do on my own.
That's awesome. I think, yeah, it does say a lot that you're able to do it in a way that's just about connecting with your body and enjoying the experience of it and not doing it for some sort of external reason, like doing it for whatever pace your watch is telling you to do, or, and that you can still have the competitive spirit that brought you, you know, that before you even had a disordered relationship with food or exercise or your body, you had sports were a part of your life. You were a high school athlete too, and ostensibly had gotten a love of it even before that, probably. So to have that still be a part of your life, it sounds like it's important. It's an important part of your values, but you had to figure out a way to do it that wasn't going to be sucking you back into diet culture.
Exactly. I think, you know, I still have that recognition of, okay, if there's a day where the weather is amazing, like, you know, I'm looking out the window right now, the sun is out, and there's a part of me that's itching to get out there. But as busy as my schedule is, I'm starting to ask myself that question more and more of, okay, where is this anxiety arising from? Is it the discomfort and the fact that I'm, quote unquote, missing out on this amazing weather? Is it the idea that if I, you know, am not active today, that I've somehow been less productive? And just, I think asking more of those uncomfortable questions that I may or may not like the answer to, but then also being prepared to sit with that anxiety. And I've thankfully been able to receive support in working through that as well, because in the past, you know, that would have been the catalyst for saying, okay, I don't care what else is going on, clear my schedule, I'm making this happen. And that in and of itself is a very disordered behavior for me in the past when it came to compulsive exercise.
Right. Putting aside the other things in your life that were going on in favor of exercise.
Right. Right. So at this point, I think it's a somewhat unique journey that would have brought me to this place. And I certainly don't want to make it sound like this is where everyone can or should arrive, because I think your relationship with movement has to be something that you discover on your own. And if this example, you know, is resonating with anyone, then, you know, I'm optimistic that you can arrive in this place too, because it does feel so good. But at the same time, it's perfectly okay if you don't get there. If you realize that movement is something that doesn't serve you, or maybe the type of movement that you have been told you, quote unquote, should do isn't serving you, then I think it's also important to point out that that's perfectly okay. And maybe that will change, maybe it won't, but it's not something that we have to force or really focus effort into. We can just trust our bodies, trust the process, and let it be what it is.
Yeah, and you're allowed to not do movement. I think that's a huge point that people need to hear and understand, is that it's not about that you have to find some form of movement. In some points of your life, you might just need to not do movement at all. And that's absolutely okay. And you 100% have permission to do that. And maybe at some point down the line, you'll find yourself itching to do something from a genuine place and not from a diet culture place. Because of course, sometimes that itch is coming from a place of like, oh my God, I got to change my body, or I got to keep it from getting larger or whatever. But it could be eventually coming from a place of like, yeah, I just want to feel that feeling that I enjoy when I do this activity. And sometimes people can't go back to the activity that ended up getting so caught up in diet culture. Like for me, I ran in childhood and adolescence, and actually was on my track team in high school as well. And I did sprinting and did a little bit of like through the discus and stuff too, but I was mostly into sprinting. And afterwards in college, when I developed my disordered relationship with food and exercise, running became a very compulsive thing for me. It became like a form of overexercise and a way that I punished myself and a way that I tried to shrink my body. And it just was so caught up in that. And then gym culture as well. I would go to the gym a lot as well. And just that environment doesn't work for me anymore. And running really doesn't work for me anymore either. I tried it. I tried to sort of get back into it from a very different place after I had healed my relationship with exercise, and realized that the sort of joy that was once there for me in childhood, that was basically like challenging someone to a race. Like that was what I always loved, was just like racing somebody. And that's why I ended up sprinting in high school. And that is actually still there. Like occasionally, if there's like a big field that I'm walking across with my husband, I'll be like, I'll race you to the end or whatever. But otherwise, I have no desire to run. And actually, even in high school, when I was on the track team, I had no desire to like train. I had no desire to do the training runs that the coach made us do. I was like, oh, this is so boring. This is so terrible. I hate running long distances. All I want to do is race somebody. And so, you know, I just was able to throw that out and say, like, running isn't really a part of my life anymore. It's not a part of my movement practice anymore, other than those moments of just like, oh, I want to like race across this field because it seems fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's such a good point to make too, you know, movement and exercise and health. I mean, none of those things are things that you owe to anybody. I mean, it's one of those things that if that's a personal value of yours and you're able to discover a way that you can sustain that and bring that into your life, it's like, great, I'm all for it. But I think where we get caught up so much of the time with diet culture is this expectation of what we should be doing, and that our worth and value is so tied up in how we exemplify those behaviors. When in reality, I mean, it does not personally affect my life in any way for someone else to disengage from that if it's not a value that they hold. Or maybe it is a value that they hold, but they just don't have the capacity to bring that into their life right now. You know, I think that's another aspect of privilege in this wellness diet that we see all the time, is just because you recognize that as a value means that you should be prioritizing it over other things. And that, I think, is a really unfortunate message that gets twisted pretty often.
That's such a great point, that it's not of anybody else's business. It's not your doctor's business. It's not your mom's business. It's not your best friend's business. It's certainly not strangers on Instagram's business, whether or not you are moving your body in any way, and what way in which you choose to move your body is nobody's business either. And if it's a part of your journey right now, or part of your path toward reconnecting with intuitive eating and intuitive movement, that you need to stop moving for a while. And I would say that for anyone who has struggled with compulsive exercise or an eating disorder of any kind, really taking a pause from movement, I think, is the best thing, especially, you know, if movement has been a source of punishment in any way, or even if you've been like reflexively avoiding movement because it feels like punishment. I think taking that off the table, making it not something that you're pushing yourself to do, is really an important part of the healing process. And eventually, maybe you'll get back to it in some way, but maybe you won't, or maybe who knows how that's going to show up in your life. And it really does not matter. There's no moral obligation to move your body.
Yes. And that's such a strong point that I try to make clear to the clients that I work with in my professional practice, is that for so many of them, their only form of movement that they've ever experienced has been really intertwined with an active attempt to lose weight or an active attempt to change their body. And it's really challenging for a lot of us to disengage from that idea that, you know, we're only moving our body because we hope that it will change in some way. It's like, if we can just let that go and ask that question of, okay, would I still be doing this if there was 0% chance that my body would change as a result of it? There's your answer. Like, if you really enjoy it and you would do it regardless until the end of your days, that is your answer. And that's kind of the litmus test that I've been applying a lot of the times, is if I go to a class at a fitness studio, or I try a new form of movement, and I ask myself that question, I'm like, did I enjoy this enough to, you know, continue doing it? And of course, the motivation is not with the idea that my body would change as a result, but it's just a good litmus test that I've found to ask that question of, okay, why am I really out here doing this right now? What's the point?
Yeah. And if you notice that you're doing it for body change reasons, can you stop? Like, that was a huge thing for me in my healing from overexercise, was promising myself, okay, if movement is coming from, if my motivation to do something is coming from reason one or reason two being body change, like if that was one of my top reasons for doing this activity, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to say, you know what? I'm going to disengage. I'm going to not go to this class. I'm going to shut down this video that I'm trying to do. I'm going to stop this run, like whatever it is. You know, I decided like I was just going to step off if I felt that it was actually coming from a place of wanting to change or shrink my body. And that was huge. Like and actually, you know, knowing a little more now about the neuroscience of it, it's understandable that it was sort of creating new neural pathways that disconnected the idea of movement from the idea of body shrinkage or diet culture outcomes, and was able to help build new neural pathways of movement equals fun, movement equals feeling better in my body, maybe movement equals helping address chronic pain, all these self-care reasons to move your body rather than movement for diet culture purposes. So I really recommend that to people. And I've had a number of clients say that that was a huge key in their healing from disordered relationships with exercise too, was to apply that principle to themselves and say, like, I'm not going to let myself do this if the main motivation is coming from a place of wanting to change my body. And I always say main motivation, because it's like, of course, in diet culture, it might be many reasons down the list. There's this tiny voice being like, and maybe I'll lose weight, you know, and that's, of course, that's going to still be there pretty much across the board in diet culture. But if you can at least start with the really obvious forms where it's like clear to you that you're doing it just for that, just for the sake of that, then you can sort of get to those subtler levels in time.
And that was the aspect that I was so resistant to. You know, as I was rejecting diet culture in the food arena, that part came a little bit more easily. But because my identity had always been so wrapped up in being an athlete and being this highly active person, that's where I felt the biggest resistance. You know, I would kind of bump up against it. And I was so uncomfortable to sit with that anxiety of not moving my body that I would say, okay, I feel it. I don't like it. I'm going to go back to what I know. And it took a lot of instances of that happening to get more comfortable with being so uncomfortable, to just feel that sensation of sitting still. The reason that I struggle with yoga to this day is because it's that aspect of stillness that I think really forces me to be in my body, you know, especially as I'm doing more work and more learning about embodiment and just simply existing and experiencing your body. I think the stillness aspect is still one of the areas where I'll bump up against that resistance and really have to just sit with it for a while and revisit it and come back to it again and again to move through it. Because if I don't revisit it, then it's easy to just set it on the shelf and say, okay, that's not something that I like. I'm not going to go there again. And I think just being courageous enough to keep trying it. And so with things like putting the pause on running or traveling and not bringing any clothes to go to the gym or be active, you know, those are small ways that I've started to test it and will continue to do so. Because as you said, it never truly disappears because of the culture that we live in. That diet culture message is constantly being reinforced and that mean girl is just chirping up in our ear all the time. And so continuing to do that, I think, is a really important part of staying in this more healed place that I'm in right now.
Yeah. And we do have to constantly talk back to it, right? Because it's like we live in this culture that is constantly mean girling at us from all angles, or to use the life thief metaphor, like trying to steal our lives in all kinds of ways. It's like this conniving, terrible person, whoever it is. Diet culture is the worst.
Oh, yeah.
And it's ubiquitous. So we have to be vigilant all the time.
Right. Well, and because, you know, mean girls are so catty and nasty and bitchy, it's like, okay, well, if I want to be a bitch right back, I totally can. Like, you know, I'm going to dish it out just like they've been giving it to me. And I think, you know, going back to what you said about giving it a persona being a helpful aspect of that healing process, just being able to see it for what it is and asking that question of, if I really am aspiring to be a better person, not only to myself, but to others, it's like, is this something that I would say to a friend? Or is this something that I would like gossip about behind someone's back? And I'm like, am I being a mean girl right now? And unfortunately, like, yes, I will totally own the fact that I've been that girl in the past and will likely be her again. But having that recognition of saying, this is what it is. It's just diet culture coming into my life. I don't want it here. I don't have to engage with it. I don't have to participate.
Yeah. And just drawing that boundary, setting a boundary on this aspect that feels like a part of yourself, but is actually, again, that sort of other persona that you don't have to engage with, or you don't want to, you know, you can say, I don't want you in my life anymore. I want to draw a line here. And it's hard to kick it out. It takes a lot of time and a lot of practice and a lot of talking back to it. But I think that idea of just giving it a name, giving it a voice, and something that's sort of separate from you is very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, I could talk to you forever. This is such good stuff. And I've loved our conversation. Can you tell people where they can find you and learn more about your work?
Of course, I'd be happy to. So I'm in this interesting place where I'm actually operating two businesses right now. Street Smart Nutrition is, like I was referring to earlier, very much my personal brand. I maintain a food blog and I'm really active on social media. So you can find me at StreetSmartRD on Instagram, also Twitter and Facebook, although they aren't my favorite platforms at this point. And then my new business venture is called Libre Connections. And this is where I've shifted all of my virtual coaching and counseling for intuitive eating and nutrition. And we're in this interesting phase where, as a startup, you know, it's very early in what we're doing, but there's some really exciting things coming down the pipeline. And I'm so eager to get this service out into the world. And we've sort of put things in play with a podcast of my own. We call it You Can Eat With Us, which is, of course, a play on words and sort of a reference to Mean Girls, if you've seen the movie. You can also find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter as Libre Connections.
And that's really cool because that's a service that connects people to Haze, non-diet, intuitive eating dietitians anywhere in the country, right? Or is it in the world?
So it's 100% virtual based, with the idea being that I really want to break down the barriers between people who are interested in learning more or they want to start their journey and they recognize that they may need a helping hand. And then, of course, on the reverse side, we've got the helping hands there to give it. So in my experience as a private practice dietitian, there was always this level of frustration and really fear. It kind of came down to a scarcity mindset of never being able to carry the client load or generate the revenue that would really, you know, support my lifestyle or keep me in business. And so the twofold mission is to not only make Haze-informed intuitive eating coaches available to the wider public, but to also allow an opportunity for dietitians who prefer to practice in that style, being able to deliver those services in a way that they can feel very professionally fulfilled and continue to grow those skills and develop their counseling techniques to better serve the people who are on the receiving end.
Oh, that's awesome. I love it. It's a cool double mission. And I think a lot of people listening to the podcast will probably be interested, both people who are seeking out those services and people who are dietitians who want to expand their practice in that way. So that's very cool.
Right, right. Yeah, we're hoping that 2019 is a huge year for us. There's so many things that I want to get done, but as I'm sure you know, there's only so many hours in the day and it takes time, you know, to build something from scratch. So that's where we're at right now.
Well, it's exciting. We'll put links to that in the show notes so people can find you and check it out. And yeah, here's to 2019 being a big year for both of us. I think it's off to a good start, hopefully, by the time people hear this.
Yes. Thank you so much for inviting me onto the podcast. I'm eagerly awaiting your book to come out and so thankful for all the work that you've done in this area. I've been a huge fan of the podcast for such a long time, and I've really enjoyed our conversation. So thank you again.
Thank you so much, Kara. It's really a pleasure talking with you, and I appreciate that. So that's our show. Thanks again so much to Kara Harbstreet for joining us on this episode, and thanks to you for listening. If you've gotten something out of this podcast, please help us reach more people who need to hear the anti-diet message, because everyone does in this culture, by subscribing and sharing this episode on your favorite podcast platform. Just go to ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe to see all the places you can get it. That's ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe. If you're looking for some practical tips to get started on your own anti-diet journey, grab my free audio guide, 7 Simple Strategies for Finding Peace and Freedom with Food. Just go to ChristyHarrison.com/strategies to get it. That's ChristyHarrison.com/strategies. And then to get full show notes from this episode, including all the resources we mentioned, plus a full transcript, head over to ChristyHarrison.com/182. That's ChristyHarrison.com/182. And to get the transcript, just scroll down to the bottom of the page and enter your email address. This episode was brought to you by Blinkist. In this day and age, it can be hard to sit down and learn more. You may think you don't even have time to read a book. Well, think again. Blinkist is the only app that condenses thousands of nonfiction books into the best key takeaways, so you can read or listen to them in just 15 minutes. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/foodpsych and start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/foodpsych to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist.com/foodpsych, F-O-O-D-P-S-Y-C-H. A big thanks to our editor and engineer, Mike Lalonde, and to my Food Psych Programs team, including our community and content associate, Vinci Chui, our administrative assistant, Julianne Watasik, and our transcript assistant, Kiara McClellan, for helping me out with all the moving parts that go into producing this show for you every week. Our album art was photographed by Abby Moore Photography and designed by Meredith Noble. Our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs. And I'm your host and producer, Christy Harrison. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay psyched.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.